Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Little Dudes Insects Academy podcast with your host, Braden Coy, and I could not be more excited to be here with my new friend, George. We met at the ESA conference back in November a while back, but we're back, and we are so excited to talk about bugs with you guys for a little bit. So I'm super excited about this episode, so without further ado, go ahead and introduce yourself for us, George.
Yeah, so I'm George Todd. I am originally from Carmel, Indiana, which is in the Indianapolis area of Indiana, and lived there most of my life, and then also lived in South Georgia for several years. And now I currently live in St. Louis, and I am a PhD student in biology and at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, studying insect pollinators.
Amazing. Yeah, and we'll dive all into your research in just a minute, but let's talk a little bit more about your schooling. So let's go back to the beginning. Where did you go to school for your undergrad, and what have you kind of done so far throughout your schooling career?
So I went to Purdue University for my undergrad degree, a Bachelor of Science
awesome.
In biology. Purdue's a Big Ten school. It's Indiana's land-grant university. Really great school. Of course, I'm biased to that, of course. But yeah. I studied biology and took a lot of the typical classes there, but I also discovered a more specific interest in animal behavior and physiology as a kind of subfield within that. And I, through the encouragement of my advisor, my academic advisor, and a couple other students that I knew older than me, I decided to pursue joining one or two different labs in the biology department at Purdue to get involved and see what research entailed, what it was like. And so I was in two different labs. The first lab I joined, it was actually in the food science department. Mm-hmm. And that lab was investigating bioavailability of different kinds of molecules and things. And they used pigs and Zucker rats as study systems to investigate that. And so in that lab, I did more basic things, which comprised mostly husbandry duties. So taking care of the animals. And I also did some basic data collection for one of the PhD students that was in the lab.
Okay.
So that was, I think, a good opportunity to get my feet wet in research. And then the second lab I was involved in was a bird behavior and physiology lab that studied behavior and physiology in birds. And so I worked with a postdoc specifically in that lab studying the foraging behavior of house sparrows. So how they looked for and obtained food, in particular against different colored backgrounds and in different environmental contexts. And so I got more involved in that process and actually presented some of that research at a couple different conferences. And so that was really great for my professional development.
Yeah.
I decided I wanted to, as I was getting to graduation, I wanted to pursue a master's degree. And so I had actually met somebody at a conference in Austin, Texas, who was a professor at Georgia Southern University. And he was looking for a new master's student to do research studying animal behavior in snakes. And so completely different kind of animal, obviously, but the underlying questions that he was trying to address were very similar. And so I actually emailed him at the conference and met him the next day. And one thing led to another, and I applied to the school and got accepted. And so I went and got a master's degree at Georgia Southern University, which is very far south Georgia, kind of getting towards the coast. And I studied thermoregulatory behavior in corn snakes, specifically. So that was a very great experience. And something else of note that I did also was I was a teaching assistant. So I was on a TA.
That's great.
And I was, you know, super anxious about it. I did it just to be able to get the tuition waiver and get a stipend. It's
right.
Very common for graduate students. But slowly I began to realize that there were certain aspects about teaching that I actually enjoyed and found fulfilling. And as I was getting towards graduation, I was really aiming initially more towards getting a job in field biology and or the conservation or wildlife biology work. but I decided to broaden what I was looking for and also include different kinds of teaching jobs if they popped up. And in fact, one did at a technical college about a couple hours away from there, teaching primarily dual enrollment high school students general biology, as well as traditional students on campus during the summers. And I that kind of unique dynamic in that job kind of appealed to me. And so I applied and got the job. And so I moved to Waycross, Georgia, just a couple hours away. And I taught at Coastal Pines Technical College for 5 years.
Oh, wow.
And so that, yeah, I was there for a little while. And I did, as much as I like the high school students, I did kind of miss teaching undergraduates. And I also wanted to be able to mentor undergraduates in research experiences, and I really wasn't getting that in that job.
It's just a different environment for sure.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And so that led me to realize I think I'm going to have to get a PhD, just because even with a master's degree, it's very difficult to get non-adjunct or non-part-time jobs.
Right.
Teaching in higher education. And so I spent a couple of years applying to schools, didn't get into some of them. And I discovered Professor Amy Dunlap, my advisor's research in her lab here at UMSL, and really, really liked the questions she was asking and using insect pollinators as a study system. And so I applied and got accepted, and I actually met my wife and married in Waycross, Georgia. And so both her and I moved here to St. Louis.
That's
in
great.
Fall of 2021. And so now I'm in year three of the PhD program and making good progress, and it's going well.
That's awesome. Yeah. So, I mean, you've done it all. You've done snakes, lots of snakes, birds, and you're just now doing insects, right? Because you didn't really do much of that before.
Correct.
Yeah. So what led you to that? And what have you been doing with your pollinator research?
I applied to different schools at the time. I applied to different schools, and there were different kinds of animals that these labs were investigating and doing research with. And I was not particularly picky about what study system I used, because I, at that point, had already had some diversity of different, very different kinds of animals.
Right.
But this work with insects just was particularly interesting to me. And one thing I can remember specifically is I had a Zoom meeting with a couple of grad students in her lab at the time. They're both graduated now, but I had a Zoom meeting with them just to get their perspective on what it's like being in the Dunlap lab at UMSL, what the department's like, what life in St. Louis is like, all those things. And they spoke really highly of those things in general. But then when they talked about their specific research and other things that were happening in the lab, that kind of really piqued my interest. I'd always loved insects. Just hadn't really, I kind of knew a lot of the basic things that you learn in biology about insects, a lot of the different kinds of groups, their life history and evolution and ecological roles, all of those kinds of things. But I discovered that there's just a whole nother level that you can dive into, and it's really fascinating. So, and what I do right now is most of my lab actually works with bumblebees. And they study, the lab studies cognition in particular in insect pollinators. And so cognition is just the thought process, the process that the brain goes through in different stages, starting with sensing the environment, processing that information. Is there memory of that information involved, potentially? And then ultimately making a decision based on that information gained. So that entire cognitive process, you can actually study that very well in insects, and a lot of things have been learned in doing that. And so other people in my lab do study bumblebees, and you can order bumblebee colonies commercially. So they'll actually ship you a bumblebee colony, and you take them one by one out of the box that they're shipped in, and you put them in an enclosure in the lab, and you provide them everything that they need, food resources. You clean the space, of course.
Wow.
And so I was initially, when I was brainstorming what I wanted my PhD dissertation to be on. I was thinking about a lot of things with bumblebees, of course, but I was also thinking about other insect pollinators like butterflies and moths, beetles. There are also fly pollinators, though, and I discovered a group of flies called hoverflies. Most people call them sweat bees, but they're actually flies that mimic bees and wasps. So they will have a lot of the yellow and black coloration patterns of bees and wasps. And I did not really know, honestly, that they existed prior to coming into the program. And I discovered them and also discovered that the case can be made that they're actually like the second most important pollinator group in the world. So
really?
Most people pretty unanimously agree that bees are the most important group, both ecologically as well as economically for human food crops. But as soon as you start to go down that list, it gets a little fuzzy. You can make different arguments about, you know, which groups are more important than others.
Right.
But hoverflies have a very strong case to really be the second most important group. And so when I learned that, I figured, okay, there's a good amount of bee research that's been done and about their cognition in the process of pollination. So if hoverflies are almost as important, you'd figure there might be a little less research done on them, but still maybe somewhat in the same ballpark. But
right.
It turns out that's really not the case.
Mm.
Bumblebee research is like up, or sorry, bee research is up here, and then hoverfly research is like way down here.
Really?
So there's a very huge gap in knowledge in the literature. And I decided I'm going to write a dissertation and try to fill in just a tiny piece of that gap in knowledge about hoverfly cognition. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So, for those at home who don't know, what, like, go over the hoverfly and why are they like so interesting and special?
Sure. So they're unique in two ways. So they're in the order of insects called Diptera, which is just the true flies. So there are flies that have the word fly in them that actually aren't in this group. So for example, dragonflies are not true flies.
Yep.
And there's a number of other things, but the Dipteran flies are true flies,
mm-hmm.
and hoverflies fall within this group, and they are typically characterized as many of them do not have interesting coloration patterns. You have a lot of flies, Dipteran flies, that are black, or gray, or brown, or some mix of those. But hoverflies are unique, as I said, in that they exhibit coloration patterns that are believed to be a form of Batesian mimicry of bees and wasps, which means that they exhibit coloration patterns that are very similar to another type of animal to act as a defense mechanism against potential predators.
Mm.
And so these hoverflies, as adults, they exhibit that, but then also their larval form are very interesting. So their maggot form or their larval form, they're ecologically relevant because a lot of hoverfly larvae actually consume a lot of crop pests such as aphids and other things, and so that's very relevant for humans just because there are a lot of crop pests that cause a massive amount of monetary damage to crops, and so aphids are a big one. But a lot of hoverfly larvae, the hoverflies will lay their eggs on the plants, they'll hatch into larvae, and the larvae will start eating the aphids or other things. So
I did not know that.
Yeah, so there's some research going into potentially supplementing different areas of farmland or areas where you grow food with hoverflies, bringing adults in somehow, or even just larvae to try to help as a natural defense against these pests that these flies provide. And so also what I tell people is that it's, compared to my other lab mates that study bumblebees, it's nice to work with hoverflies because they don't sting.
Yeah.
There are no flies that sting. And so although the hoverflies look like bees and wasps, they actually are harmless to humans. So they can't sting you. Occasionally I'll have another person in the lab. A bee will get out and they'll sting somebody. That just happens. And we have precautionary safety measures in place for that. But working with hoverflies, I don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, and that's so awesome. Yeah. How about the, I actually don't know much about hoverflies, so this is super interesting to me. What's like the distribution? Are they like where are they native to?
So there are about 6,300 species
Oh, wow.
described globally.
Mm-hmm.
And they are found in basically every part of the world except for the extreme poles, so in Antarctica and then kind of the extreme Arctic. So that's fairly common of other kinds of insect groups that are also just found globally. It's really hard to find insects above a certain latitude on either pole. So there's hoverflies over in Europe and Asia that are different from the hoverfly species in North America. But there's ones that are in South America and Africa and Australia.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah, and are they all about the same size, or are there small ones and bigger ones, or are they sort of all the same?
There are ones that are quite small that are almost fruit fly sized.
Oh, wow.
So fruit flies are quite small. And so there are some species that kind of approach that. And then on the other end, there are flies that are like horsefly sized. So yeah, kind of showing the finger size. Yeah. So the little tiny ones, are fruit fly size, but there are others that are maybe like this big. So pretty decent size range.
Yeah, that's really awesome. Super interesting. Yeah, this is really cool. Yeah, so they have like a unique flight pattern, right? They don't really like a different wing kind of, right? Am I being correct there?
So they actually their wings aren't really particularly unique. It's their ability to hover, and so that's in the name, the hoverfly. And so most flies and most insects actually don't have the capacity to hover in one spot in the air. There are actually some bees that can do that. And so there's exceptions throughout all insects. But hoverflies as a group, there are a lot of species that have the ability to hover. And hovering is very useful in spatial navigation and getting your bearings, making decisions about where to fly next, what to chase, if it's a male chasing away another male, for example. So there's certain advantages that come with being able to hover. Sometimes it can be advantageous for pollinating, and so these adult hoverflies pollinate flowers, and being able to hover can provide certain advantages if the positioning of the flower is difficult to try to navigate by landing on it. So being able to hover can be useful there too.
Yeah, super interesting. When you brought up the research on cognition, I'm kind of interested in that. How is that a measurable thing? Like, how do you, is it video? Like, do you video it, or like, how is that how can you measure that? That's interesting to me.
Sure. So at the sensory stage, determining what animals can sense, such as through vision or smell or taste or those different things, you generally have two means, and this kind of extends out more broadly to studying both behavior and physiology. So you can take a physiological route and perform dissections and actually look for specific, for example, like photoreceptors in the eye. You can look for specific structures like on the antennae, which are used in insects to smell. You can look for certain kinds of sensory hairs that are on the antennae, or you can look at the densities of the hairs. So that's kind of a more physiological route, but you can also take behavioral routes and set up experiments where you present different kinds of environments, and you either record or observe in real time the different decisions in response to these certain environments that they make. And that tells you information about that can reveal what kinds of things they're sensing about the environment, which things they aren't. And so there's some researchers who like to use those two kinds of avenues in tandem together to make some more powerful conclusions. And then there's also even genetic component a genetic route you can take and look for specific kinds of genes that we have identified as being genes that ultimately code for creating a certain kind of receptor cell or protein or something like that. So I guess kind of three different avenues you can take. And that's for sensory as an example.
Super bizarre. Yeah, so like, what species do you work with, or do you work with you know, all the native ones in St. Louis?
I work with the native ones in St. Louis, and in my first couple of years in the program, I spent the spring and summers doing some basic survey work to see what kinds of species are around in St. Louis, and then also what their relative abundance levels are, or in other words, like how easy or difficult is it to find them in different areas.
Right.
So I have a number of sites and areas in the St. Louis, in St. Louis. Some of them are actually quite urban. And so you can find hoverflies in urban areas, which is also kind of nice. Some insects, you just like really don't find them in urban areas for various reasons, whereas others are quite urban adapted and do fine. And so there are a number of hoverfly species that seem to do quite fine in urban areas, which makes it easier to find them. You don't have to go way out to a natural area 50 miles away or something. So I would say there is a list of about 10 species or so that I can say with confidence that I would be able to go out, say, in this upcoming field season I'm about to embark on later in the spring and in the summer. Yeah. There's about 10 species I could confidently say I can go to this in this area and find at least several individuals, and you use a net and you can net them. They're a little harder to net than bees, just because flies tend to be more agile. But with some practice, you kind of get the hang of it.
Yeah, super, super cool. Really awesome work. So like, what is the application and like implication of this research?
So our world is complex, right? The world's complex naturally, but then there's also a dimension of complexity that's added when humans alter and change environments. And whether or not that change is good or bad for people or animals, ultimately it is still change. And so animals have to contend with that kind of environmental change. Kind of thinking about cognition is that's one kind of specific area that you can investigate to see, for example, how much neural flexibility is there, or you can think of that as neural plasticity, but how much flexibility is there in the brain to make changes based on what's changing in the environment. And so ultimately the more you learn and understand the cognitive process of a given animal, the more you can make more informed decisions about, say, like conservation or understanding what specifically about a given habitat or area is most important for a given animal species to succeed and thrive. What other kinds of species it interacts with are most important. And to give you a more specific example with these hoverflies, what really matters to them a lot for the success of their life cycle is what kinds of species of flowering plants are available and how many of them there are. And that's a particularly complex thing in an urban area, just because that, you know, this person's backyard may have a lot of flowers and the next person, their neighbor, has, you know, like basically none. And so there's a ton of variability. And so these hoverflies, along with other insect pollinators, have to contend with that and make decisions based on what's provided. And so understanding the cognitive process that allows them to succeed, that helps you understand what in the environment you might want to prioritize keeping around, or not just for larger scale conservation efforts, but even just for somebody who lives in the city or lives in the suburb and wants to know what they can do with their backyard to help pollinators. And yeah.
Yeah. So cool. So George, let's go back, take a step back a little bit, talk a little bit more about you. You mentioned that, you've worked with, you know, all kinds of animals, but, how did you originally get like into entomology specifically? Like what, was there, I mean, you mentioned that your work in your PhD so far has gotten, you into that, but was there like a moment where you were like, yeah, entomology is really cool, or are you still open to going back and working with other animals?
I honestly would say I fall into the latter category just because of all of the my past experience I have with those other animal groups that you just mentioned. And in particular, I say that just because of my future goals. So I ultimately want to get a teaching focused position in higher education.
Right.
And so I don't want to be a principal investigator of a large research lab at a research institution and have a lot of undergraduates and graduate students and postdocs all working under me and have to constantly be writing grants and trying to look to apply for tenure and all of those things that kind of seems kind of overwhelming to me. And that's just not really what I'm like passionate about pursuing, but I'm more passionate about teaching and then also still helping facilitate and mentor undergraduate students and potentially graduate students, depending on the circumstances in research endeavors because of the research experience that I have. And I kind of think of the entomology in my academic career right now as kind of it's another specific experience and another kind of tool that I have in my arsenal to use as a potential study system for research, depending on what interests the students that I'm mentoring have. I will say one nice thing about insects is that it is generally much easier to work with them from the perspective of having to write protocols and get approval to have them in the lab or to do things to them. So with vertebrates or mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fishes, you usually have to write IACUC protocols that where you explicitly state what your objectives are, what you're planning on doing, why those things are necessary to achieve those objectives. You have to outline all of that very clearly to get permission to go out and collect whatever or house them in the lab or do X, or Y, or Z to them. Invertebrates, like insects, you generally don't have that. So you can kind of just go and collect them at will and then bring them into the lab and do what you want, you know, which doesn't mean that you necessarily should, just because we know that insects do experience pain. But it's just kind of, it frees up a lot of time at the very least. So that's also been something I've been enjoying.
Yeah. That's a good point that I never really thought about. They're, you know, really, I wouldn't say they're easy to find, but, you know, they're plentiful, they're a lot less ethical concern with bringing them in and all that stuff, less dangerous typically. And like a lot of people have said in the past on the show, it's like nobody really cares if like some die in your experiments. It happens all the time. So so that's a great point that I never really thought about is from an administrative perspective, I'm sure it's way easier to get them for the lab. Really, really interesting. Really cool. Moving on to a little bit more about you, who along the way has sort of pushed you along and inspired you, throughout your career so far, like a mentor or any professors or like, who's your inspiration with all of this?
So even early on, my parents and my family, in general, I've always like supported that interest I've had in animals, even as a kid, but going through high school, there was nothing about that general interest in animals and biology that they tried to stifle or, you know, were not supportive of. So that's kind of just a general support. But more specifically, when I got to Purdue University and was in the bird lab specifically, the postdoc that I worked for, her name's Amanda Ensminger. She was the first person that I can specifically say really played a major role in really fostering my interest and passion, and then also really invested a lot in me developing professionally in animal research. And I say that just because she could have very easily not have tried to get me as involved in the research experiments and actually like running the experiments as she did, but she like was very adamant, like, this would be really, really good for you to take on that more of that responsibility.
Right.
And and get that experience. And then she also really encouraged me to present my work at a couple conferences, and that was also excellent. And then also she really assisted me in the application process to grad school when I was applying to Georgia Southern University. So the application process is different than typically when you're applying to just go to school for an undergraduate degree, in that you typically, unless you're doing like rotations, that's kind of a little different. But in a lot of like ecological research in biology departments, you usually often will try to meet your advisor beforehand and get a feel for their research, but also how they run the lab, what are typical expectations they have of their students. And you try to build that relationship a little beforehand to give you the best idea of whether that school and lab would be a good fit or not. And so she helped explain all of that, and she helped me figure out what the best questions to ask my potential advisor would be. She helped review my application materials. I went on a campus visit where I drove 11 hours down to the university in one day, stayed at my advisor's house that night, and then toured the campus and met with faculty and did all that, the visit stuff, the next day, and then stayed at a grad student's house that night, and then the next day drove all the way back 11 hours up to Purdue. And so that was a busy trip. And I had never driven anywhere near that length of time in one sitting before.
Man.
So she also helped walk me through that process as well. And so I owe a lot to her. She was very, very nice and very excellent research scientist and postdoc at that time, but just also really, really clearly cared about my development and helped me along and towards grad school. And then beyond that, there's also people I have nothing but praise to give, both my master's degree advisor and my current advisor. They're both very great. We communicate well. Expectations are very clear. Lots of support and advice. So I would say my past and current advisors as well are also a great spot of support.
That's awesome. I love that. So in your spare time, either apart from biology or related to it, what are some other hobbies that you enjoy to sort of relax and, spend your spare time?
Interestingly, my biggest hobby uses the exact opposite part of my brain from all the analytical side with my work, and that is I am a musician and I play the trombone,
Oh, really?
actually. Yeah, I started playing in middle school, which is pretty typical for a lot of students at that age, and I have been playing ever since, and that was like 2003 when I started, so it's been a little while. And my favorite kind of music is jazz. I love playing jazz. I love listening to jazz and playing jazz when I get the opportunity. But I'm classically trained, and so I enjoy playing in orchestras as well as wind symphonies, chamber groups. I actually met my wife in Waycross, Georgia. We were both playing in the pit orchestra for the local community theater group's musical performance that they do every spring. And so my wife plays cello, and so we actually met at the very first rehearsal for one of those musicals.
That's
And
awesome.
so it's actually through music that I met my wife, which I've always loved.
That's
And
great.
so I enjoy playing trombone. I also enjoy playing chess, which I learned as a kid, but really didn't seriously kind of get into until much more recently than playing trombone. I think it was, like 2018 or something like that. I kind of started playing more online chess, but I prefer playing people over the board
Over
in
real life,
person.
yep.
So that's kind of a little more, analytical, but I really enjoy that as well.
Fantastic. I love that. Great game, just classic. Exercises your brain really well. And it totally makes sense that a scientist would be into chess. It's like goes hand in hand, I often find. So cool. I love that. So what are your big plans for the future after you graduate? Like, what What are some research you want to do? Are you sort of keeping an open mind? Any trips you want to go on? Anything like that? What are your big plans?
So I want to get a teaching focused position in higher education, and my wife and I are not particularly pinned down to any specific location. I would probably prefer to stay in the United States, mm-hmm. But in terms of what region I'd like to go to, a lot of my family is still in the Indianapolis, Indiana area, mm-hmm. but her family is kind of like spread out in different locations, and so sometimes where people's families are, you know, plays a role, of course, and where ultimately yep. decide to pursue a career, you know, or raise a family and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I would consider. But and also the kind of university that I like to work at, like, for example, a smaller liberal arts college versus a larger like research institution. I'm also up for kind of either of those or anything in between. It would just depend on what the specific duties and responsibilities are for the position that they're looking to fill, and right. whether that kind of aligns with what I think I would be able to flourish in. And mm-hmm. In terms of the kinds of research questions I'd like to pursue in the context of mentoring students and giving them opportunities to do research, I'm fairly open to, of course, animal behavior questions, but even some questions that more broadly fall under just like ecological questions.
Right.
I'm also open to, and I would love to be able to teach courses that are specific to my interests, like animal behavior, but I have experience teaching general biology and microbiology. So I'm kind of flexible there as well. Mm-hmm. And then you asked about trips as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I'd love to be able to travel abroad and mm-hmm. travel abroad and specifically go to beautiful, like, natural areas, natural landscapes. Something in the U.S., I'd love to go to Glacier National Park.
Yep.
Which is like in Montana,
mm-hmm.
northern part of the country, or like Banff National Park in Canada.
Yes.
I've heard is also like quite beautiful.
Yep.
Those sceneries really, really appeal to me. And I also love like hiking to some extent. I don't like do it too terribly often, but I do enjoy hiking as well.
Great. Yeah, I love that. So cool. I love the travel plans. I love exploring the natural world as well. So, really awesome. Yeah. So, George, before we wrap this up, was there any place that us viewers can go to maybe learn more about you online?
So specifically, kind of about like my work. Mm-hmm. I don't really have like great social media necessarily to follow. Yeah. However, there are a couple of recommendations I would have to anyone who's interested in learning a little more about, for example, why St. Louis actually is a great city to study urban insect pollinators. And so that would be a nonprofit organization called Seed St. Louis. Mm-hmm. Has been around since the 80s, and they're just in St. Louis, but they're an organization that strives to provide both education and service to people who manage community gardens, community orchards, and also school gardens.
I love
and
that.
So they kind of educate on how to maximize like fruit yield in gardens and orchards, and kind of different things, native things you can plant different times of the year. And so it's actually through Seed St. Louis that I have met a few people who I've asked questions about to get some more knowledge, foundational knowledge about insect pollination in the St. Louis area.
That's awesome.
And then also I would recommend to people, one of the other PhD students in my lab, Jeremy Howard, he actually hosts a podcast of his own called That Science and Nature Show.
Okay.
And he hosts it weekly, and he co-hosts it with two other graduate students in the science departments that are here at UMSL.
Love that.
And the goal is just to have discussions about different topics in science and nature, at a more general level without too much like technical jargon, and to also just have guests on week by week that kind of provide some cool insight into different topics that range from science education to the validity of scientific conspiracies. I mean, that's kind of a wide range of
Wow.
of topics
Yeah.
that are covered, but some pretty interesting topics
I love
in my
that.
opinion. So yeah.
That's so awesome. Well, thank you for giving that shout out. That's super great. Well, George, thank you so much for being on the show. This was super fun. Super interesting about hoverflies and all the crazy animals you've worked with in the past. Really awesome. So thank you so much again for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much, Braden, for having me. It's been a pleasure.